Hello, welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Hassine. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, Janice Montour becomes the first Indigenous woman to be appointed CEO of the Canadian Museums Association.
Really excited to take my cultural background and give that to the lens of a national association and really sort of maybe open perspectives a bit.
BC Hydro anticipates a strong increase in energy demand in the Northwest. $3 billion is being set aside for future infrastructure projects.
If it does look like we're going to go forward with new 500 kilovolt lines, that's going to take really about 8 to 10 years. So it's quite a long-term project.
Canadian filmmaker Amanda Dawn Christie documents the history and demise of Radio Canada International's broadcast and shortwave antennas in Sackville, New Brunswick, in the documentary Spectres of Shortwave.
Think of it like listening to a radio documentary while watching images of landscape. To me, they were just a landscape on the highway. You know, you see them and you know you're almost home.
And a BC resident has been missing for weeks. Family and friends launch a Facebook page for people who might have seen him. This and more on Viewpoints. Happy to have you with us.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Janice Montour has been appointed as the new CEO of the Canadian Museums Association in Ottawa. The former executive director of the Woodland Cultural Centre is now the first Indigenous person to hold the position. Montour hopes to take her cultural background lens and apply it to the national organization to open perspectives, but she also hopes to shine a light on the many missing communities in the museum, such as Black, Indigenous, and people of color. With Montour's departure from the Woodland Cultural Centre, the centre recently announced that Heather George will take over as the new executive director for the WCC. More with David Moses in Otwick in Ontario.
As of February 27th, Montour took over the helm of the CMA. In an interview, she said that as the first Indigenous person to hold the position of CEO with the CMA, she hopes to take her cultural background and give it to a national organization lens and open perspectives.
I think a lot of there's a lot of attention right now to it, being the first Indigenous person to hold the position. There's, you know, obviously there's been Indigenous people on the team throughout the years, but to hold it for the association, this is the first time. So there's been a lot of attention to it and a lot of responsibility that I take with that. So still very, very new to the organization, but learning lots and really excited to really, I think, take my cultural background and sort of give that to the lens of a national association and really sort of maybe open perspectives a bit.
However, she also hopes to shine a light on the many missing communities as well as build up the sector.
So a lot of the work that the Canadian Museums Association does is, you know, really trying to grow a stronger museum sector and cultural sector in the country and support those, the provincial and territorial museum associations, but also to support museums small and large across the country. And so, I'm also ensuring that we're making space for everyone's voice to be heard, not just, Indigenous, but a lot of, if we look at IPOC or BIPOC communities as well, whose narrative, is largely missing from a lot of, museums in this country. And how do we tell those stories accurately and authentically is really, really important. But also the relevance of museums. I think during COVID, the sector was hit very, very hard because we were not considered essential services by the definitions that were given. So a lot of the museums in this country were closed for several months at a time, and it had catastrophic consequences, not only in terms of like what it could have happened to collections in these museums, but also the workforce, the lack of revenue coming in to, sustain, a sector that relies heavily on government support and and our communities to support us. So I think, you know, as we come out of COVID, hopefully that we're able to build a stronger sector and really, I think, look at improving on best practices, things that are happening globally as well, in museums, and sort of trying to set a standard for Canada, really that shows really the necessary work that is happening within communities and museums.
With Montour's departure from the Woodland Cultural Center, they have also recently announced that Heather George will take over as the new ED for the Woodland Cultural Center and assumes her role as of March 20th, 2023. I'm David Moses.
Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Time now for some radio talk as we make a stop in Sackville, New Brunswick, where Canadian filmmaker Amanda Dawn Christie was presenting Spectres of Shortwave, a documentary presenting the demise of Canada's shortwave radio towers and the station linked to them, Radio Canada International. Christie didn't originally set out to document the demise of the Tantramar shortwave towers. She first wanted to create a durational landscape film featuring the towers and the marshland they occupied throughout the seasons. But then, before she had even started filming, CBC Radio Canada announced that it was scrapping its shortwave international radio service. Christie suddenly felt a responsibility to document the towers and their destruction. Christie was on site in 2014 when the shortwave radio towers planted in the Tantramar Marsh were taken down. She filmed the towers and their demolition, and the images she captured are part of her 2016 film, Spectres of Shortwave, which was recently shown in Sackville's Vogue Cinema as part of the Sackville Film Society Winter Series. Christie had a special link to the towers and to the stories and voices that came out of them, even if plenty of people who lived near the towers or drove by them regularly didn't really understand their function, says Christie. Now based in Moncton, Christie lived in Sackville for many years, during which time she became more acutely aware of the Radio Canada International site. Erica Butler met with filmmaker Amanda Dawn Christie to talk about her two-hour documentary, Spectres of Shortwave.
The drive across the Tantramar Marshes between Sackville and Amherst certainly looked different before March 2014. Back then, the marsh was populated with a group of tall radio towers, home to the CBC International Shortwave Service, RCI International. Harper-era budget cuts led to the CBC's decision to scrap the towers and the shortwave broadcasts that they sent out across the Atlantic. Experimental filmmaker Amanda Dawn Christie was there when the towers fell, and the images she captured are part of Spectres of Shortwave. Christie is based in Moncton and lived in Sackville for many years, during which time she became more acutely aware of the RCI site after having learned to build her own radio receiver.
There was an electronics workshop at Strutt's Gallery taught by Peter Fleming, and we made radio receivers out of toilet paper tubes. And my radio picked up Italian radio, and I thought that I did a great job. But it turned out, then I found out that people in houses near in and around Sackville had historically sometimes picked up the radio in their sinks and their refrigerators. So it wasn't that I did a good job building a radio. It was that I was near an international shortwave site.
Christie was fascinated enough with the idea of shortwave broadcasts picked up by sinks that she decided to construct a new receiver in 2009 while working at Strutt's. Called the Marshland Radio Plumbing Project, Christie tried to make a functioning radio receiver out of a sink using copper pipe as the antenna, two types of metal soldered together for the diode, and the sink basin as a sort of gramophone horn.
And I took it around the marsh trying to hear the radio, and I went to the radio tower site a lot and talked with the technicians. And I got their schedules to see where I could take it. So I became kind of like known to them as the radio sink girl.
That relationship with the staff at RCI came in handy years later when the organization granted Christie access to the site during the filming of Spectres of Shortwave.
They said, well, you know, what's your interest in this? What's your angle with the film? And I said, oh, I'm an artist and I'm making a landscape documentary different seasons. And I've been trying to hear the radio in a sink for a few years. And so I guess that made me seem like I wasn't too threatening to them. So they gave me access to the site. I had keys to the facility.
Christy was adventurous in collecting her footage of the towers, even going so far as to get a license to climb them. She also recalls racing to the site from Moncton one day in March 2014, just missing the fall of the first of the towers.
I was in the parking lot of the big white building when they dropped the second tower, which was really quite close to it. And I didn't even have a tripod. My camera was sitting on like the bumper of the van that I was using. And so it's a nice shot that in the film, when you see that tower fall, like it's really close and you see the camera shake with the aftershock. Cause when like the tower falls and then there's like this, you know, all the snow. And so that was pretty powerful. And that one, when it fell, I that was the one that was emotional because I wasn't, you know, it was this big rush to get there to film it. And then when it falls, it was just so dramatic. And also when it crashes to the ground, what's interesting is you expect a big loud sound, but they did it in the winter because the marsh would be frozen. Otherwise they'd sink too far into the marsh. And so they had to do it in the winter. And so when the towers hit the marsh in the snow, it's this really kind of underwhelming thud. It's more of like a poof. And you're expecting a big crash, but it makes more noise as the metal's twisting and falling than when it hits the ground.
Christy didn't originally set out to document the demise of the Tantramar shortwave towers. She started out with a plan to create a durational landscape film featuring the towers throughout the seasons. But then, before she had even started filming, CBC made their announcement, and suddenly Christy felt a responsibility to document the towers and their destruction.
When I was making the film, because it's a film about radio, I wanted the soundtrack to be important and to actually double as a radio documentary. And so in the film, for the people in the theater, like there's no talking heads. You don't see any people in the film. It's 2 hours of landscape. You've got a half hour per season. But I've interviewed a lot of people. In the first hour and a half, you hear people talking. And like originally I wanted this abstract soundscape, but because they were tearing the site down, I felt there was just more of a obligation to document it historically. So I didn't abstract the sound. I just kept the stories as they are. So you've got an hour and a half of storytelling. So when you're in the movie theater, think of it like listening to a radio documentary while watching images of landscape.
The radio quality of Christy's film also means that every time she screens it, she arranges for a simultaneous broadcast on the radio somewhere else in the world. This time, while Spectres of Shortwave screens at the Vogue Cinema in Sackville, it will also be broadcast on the radio in Dawson City, Yukon.
Because I feel like there's a connection between Sackville and Dawson City, and their radio station, community radio station, CFYT, is actually 106.9 FM. So I kind of feel like that's kind of interesting. CHMA, CFYT, 106.9 FM.
Spectres of Shortwave promises a visual and auditory experience that will recall the nearly 70-year presence of the Tantramar radio towers on the marshlands outside Sackville.
A lot of Canadians, and even people who live around the towers, didn't know what they were for. Like, to me, they were just a landscape on the highway. You know, you see them and you know you're almost home. Sackville was the perfect location for broadcasting overseas because radio waves travel better over water, and especially well over salt water. And also, normally, when you set up a big transmitting station, you would put something called in the ground called radials, which is like copper wire in the ground to make the ground more conductive. But the Tantramar Marsh is a saltwater marsh. So because of the salt in the marsh, it was already conductive. It was almost like nature had put those ground radials there to begin with. And so it was the perfect location during World War II for them to be able to broadcast to Europe and Northern Africa, because it's straight across the ocean from Sackville. So they broadcast to Europe and Africa and South America and Mexico and Australia for a while. And then, so they had Canadian broadcasting in 75 languages. that went out around the world. And so it was a service that a lot of Canadians didn't know about, because it wasn't like the CBC that goes straight to Canadians. It was destined to an international audience. And then they were also subcontracted by a lot of other countries, used that site to relay their signals. So Radio China contracted to use that site, Vatican Radio, Voice of Vietnam, NHK from Japan. So there were a lot of other countries that actually paid like a lot of money to use that site in Sackville, because it was so powerful, to basically hit this half of the globe. So it was sending original Canadian content, and then it was also relaying international content to cover this half of the planet.
That's Amanda Dawn Christie, creator of Spectres of Shortwave, a film documenting the Radio Canada International shortwave towers that once dominated the landscape of the Tanchamar Marsh.
CBC Radio Canada cut its budget down from $12 million a year to a meager $2 million. Radio Canada International then became a simple online radio. Lessons learned: never underestimate the value of your community and campus radio station and the people who populate them.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Check out our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
From transmission radio towers to power lines, BC Hydro says they are anticipating an increase in energy demand in the Northwest and sets aside a $3 billion envelope. Multiple industry developments are ongoing in the area, including liquefied natural gas projects like Cedar LNG and LNG Canada, and the Blackwater gold mine southwest of Burns Lake. Details with Morgan Budden in Terrace, BC. She spoke with Mike Kellett.
Although they're currently installing additional capacitors along the highway between Prince George and Terrace, BC Hydro is still anticipating an increase in demand in the Northwest. Mike Kellett, manager of Northern Community Relations for BC Hydro, described the ongoing power expansion project.
So we're installing additional capacitor banks at the Skeena substation to increase capacity in the region from 800 megawatts to roughly 1,400 megawatts. The issue there is that that's to meet near-term demand. It won't be enough for the potential loads that we are hearing about from stakeholders and industry in that area.
Though Kellett also explained why they've released an expression of interest despite that project.
Is the Prince George to Terrace capacitor project, which is ongoing right now, which is going to meet some short-term demand. But what's going to happen is that we believe there's a lot more demand in that area. So to serve the expected additional load, new 500 kV transmission lines, associated infrastructure are basically needed between the Williston and Skeena substations. The EOI is basically our way of putting a message out to folks who are interested in increasing the load in that area to find out where you're interested in, what are you interested, how much, what are some of the issues folks might have around that. We want to know about all of it from all of the interested parties.
Kellett talked about how they've decided to approach engagement with different parties in addition to the EOI.
Engagement related to the EOI will include outreach to existing and prospective customers, so industry associations, economic development agencies, local and regional governments, and Indigenous nations. So this will include notifying Indigenous nations about the EOI, notifying stakeholders directly about issuing the EOI, arranging one-on-one or group meetings to enable interested parties to learn about the EOI, and discussing their interconnection requirements for BC Hydro.
Though Kellett talked about the longevity of the plans to install new energy infrastructure, he also explained that the company has already allocated funds for the future project.
If it does look like we're going to go forward with new 500 kilovolt lines, that's going to take really about 8 to 10 years. So it's quite a long-term project. So we've allocated a planning allowance of about $3 billion for this development. However, cost estimates are going to be developed as these projects proceed.
Open for industry, local governments, and economic development agencies, the BC Hydro EOI is open until April 11th.
Morgan Budden in Revelstoke, BC. Two conservation organizations partnered up to protect 84 acres of Millington Bog. The nonprofit conservation organizations Appalachian Corridor and Conservation des Vallons de la Serpentine, CVS, have succeeded in protecting 84 acres of the Millington Bog in perpetuity. This adds to more than 235 acres they protected back in 2021. Appalachian Corridor and CVS started to work on protecting the Millington Bog in 2009 and are now the guardians of the property. The Millington Bog, located in Lake Memphremagog in Quebec, that's in the eastern townships, also has a rich biodiversity, says Melanie Lelièvre, executive director of Appalachian Corridor, who had a chat with Taylor McClure in Knowlton, Quebec.
Here in the region, in the Green Mountain region, there are very few bogs. So these type of wetlands are very important. This specific one is very large. So it's one of the largest bogs we have on the territory, and it occupies 652 acres, only the bog. So, and a bog is very acid. It's a very specific type of habitat. So it's an acid, rare plants, and plants that are that live in acidic soil, okay, like carnivorous plants, and as well an orchid that is quite rare as well, which is called the dragon's mouth. And it happens that this plant is the municipal floral emblem. So we're happy that the municipality has supported this project and this little tiny flower is there. And it's a beautiful, it's a wonderful orchid.
I was just going to say it almost symbolizes the importance of the project, the fact that that's the emblem of the municipality and now you're protecting that land and now its emblem can thrive, yeah, because you're protecting, yeah, that land.
It's a rare habitat for the region. It's very large. It has a rich biodiversity. It plays a very important role for the water quality of the Lake Memphremagog, oh, in the watershed of the Lake Memphremagog. And a bog is, it really acts like a gigantic sponge. It really absorbs the water during, like, large amount of water during high precipitation or flooding period. And it as well gradually releases the water during period of drought. So it's so important for the regulation of water. And as well, it filters, you know, runoff water, the sediments, pollutants that come in the bog, in the wetland, in the little stream, and after it passes through the bog, the water is really filtered. The water has been regulated and cleaned. They're like municipal infrastructures for the quality of the water.
Now, what does this mean moving forward? I know that you had a partner on this project and they are now the owners of the land, but do you hope to collaborate with them again in the future to protect even more parts of this area?
Absolutely. So when we started to discuss, I told you that we started to work in this area in 2009, got in contact with landowners in 2010. So it continues. So we're still discussing with other landowners. We're still trying to initiate other projects in the wetland complex in the Millington Bog. And so it's a very nice, again, example of collaboration, successful project where everyone works together and we're reaching the objective of protecting our nice landscape.
Thanks to Taylor McClure in Knowlton, Quebec. We cross the country back to British Columbia, where the family of Bradley James Cadden asked for clues as they continue to search for Bradley, who has been missing since March 5th. He was last seen at the Downey RV Resort on Lake Revelstoke. His family is asking anyone who drove the highway after that to report signs of the missing 39-year-old to the Revelstoke RCMP. We think he just went for a walk, said Sheila Crombie, a close friend of the Cadden family. Bradley Bradley is 5'9", has blue eyes and brown hair, and weighs 165 pounds. His family, friends, and co-workers have been working with the search and rescue and the RCMP. The family has started a Facebook page called Missing Bradley James Cadden, C-A-D-D-N. They plan to post daily updates and communicate to the public if they need help with anything. In Revelstoke, BC, here's Megan Dooling.
So the search efforts, you know, have been, you know, every day since we, you know, discovered that he was missing. So RCMP, search and rescue. We've also had volunteers, you know, pretty much close friends and family and coworkers up there. So far, we've done ground searches, aerial and fixed wing helicopter. There's been dogs out there, sleds out there. Someone had a personal drone. So every day, you know, whatever loose ends, any leads, even if they're small, you know, we go out there and we're still, even today, just out there looking.
I know that there has been a Facebook page set up and it's got a lot of people who want to help and support in the search efforts. People are offering childcare and to come and search and words of like memories and words of support. Where are we at now? What kind of information would help and what does the family need?
We're kind of limited on, you know, search efforts out there just because of the topography and everything. But if people could join that Facebook group, it's called Missing Bradley James Cadden, and share it widely, because at the end of the day, we just want that out there for, you know, anyone who might have seen him, you know, especially in that small window. So if they could go onto that Facebook group, and then also if we do need any help in the near future, we will do that on the group. And we're also going to put updates on there. We're going to try to do that daily.
And I was just looking through that before I came here, and I noticed a woman who also stays up at the RV park was maybe the one of the last people to really like notice seeing him just enjoying the sun, you know, outside his cabin up there. How important is that kind of information? Like if somebody were to have seen him walking, or just knowing that he was seen then and the state that he was in, how important is that for the search as far as you understand?
Yes, that is literally the most important piece. So that I would say that to everyone, all the public, you know, the window that we think, and, you know, we think that, you know, maybe he just went for a walk, you know, just to up the highway or down the highway. So really that window of March 5th, Sunday afternoon, was kind of the last time he was seen. And then the following, that Monday morning, March 6th, we were thinking that maybe in the evening, once it was dark, he went for a walk, you know, either north or south from there. So if anyone saw anything, especially in that window, please phone our Revelstoke RCMP. Because, you know, if they saw a person walking, any fresh tracks either side of the highway, and you know, he would, you know, would walk and walk and walk, so he could have gone like quite a ways either north or south. So anywhere, like even like, you know, say 10 to 20 kilometers north or south, anywhere in that range.
So it's common for him to go for walks, and he knows, he's used to the outdoors and he's experienced.
Yes, I mean, he for sure is very, you know, familiar and comfortable with being out in the bush. And that's why, you know, we are still actively searching. But yes, I mean, any detail, anything that anyone saw, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the biggest message is, of course, the family, you know, we love him and we just want to see him back home and safe.
Sheila Crombie is a friend of Brad Cadden and his family. Join and share the Facebook page, Missing Bradley James Cadden. In Revelstoke, I'm Megan Dooling.
That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, David Moses, Megan Dooling, Taylor McClure, Morgan Budden, Erica Butler, National Editor Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, ciao.
At Canada LJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.